For what's Universal Time, stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Ray Kugel reporting. A top Islamic State militant killed. A senior Islamic State fighter from Tunisia was killed in a U.S. drone strike in Syria. A Pentagon spokesman says Tariq bin Tahar al-Ani al-Harzi died June 16th in Shadadi. Al-Harzi helped raise money for Islamic State and oversaw efforts to bring in foreign fighters. The U.S. State Department dubbed him the Emir of Suicide Bombers. Iranian negotiators in Vienna are sending mixed signals about the pace of talks with Western powers and the country's nuclear program. British Foreign Secretary Philip Hammond says negotiators are still trying to work it all out.
Well, what I would say is that the work goes on. You're going to see over the next few days ministers coming and ministers going to maintain the momentum of these discussions. I don't think we're at any kind of breakthrough moment yet, but the work is continuing. We will do whatever we need to do to keep the momentum.
The head of the UN's nuclear watchdog organization, meanwhile, met with Iranian officials in Tehran Thursday, the latest effort to resolve long-standing questions about Iran's nuclear program. The International Monetary Fund says that debt-ridden Greece's financial plight is even worse than first thought as the country heads to Sunday's vote on whether to accept lenders' demands for more austerity in exchange for new bailouts. The IMF Thursday largely blamed the leftist government of Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras, saying that it's been too slow to sell off state assets and will need debt relief and another $56 billion in new bailout loans through 2018. Greece is cut off from further European aid after failing to meet a Tuesday midnight deadline for repaying a $1.8 billion owed the IMF. This is VOA News. Suspected Boko Haram militants have killed about 150 people in attacks in northeastern Nigeria. In the worst attack, officials say 97 people were killed in the town of Kukawa near Lake Chad Wednesday. Witnesses say gunmen entered mosques and shot men while they were praying before the end of the Ramadan fast, then attacked people's homes and shot women who were preparing meals. Six UN peacekeepers were killed and five wounded in an attack in Mali's northern desert. According to the UN peacekeeping force in Mali, the convoy was attacked Thursday in an area about 45 kilometers southwest of Timbuktu. There's been no claim of responsibility. United Nations observers say last Monday's parliamentary elections in Burundi were not free, were not fair, transparent, or credible. The UN Electoral Observer Mission says the elections took place in a climate of widespread fear and intimidation. The opposition boycotted the parliamentary election. Opponents say President Pierre Nkurunziza's bid to seek a third term in office violated the Constitution. That vote is scheduled for July 15th. An appeals court in Afghanistan overturned the death sentence given to four men involved in the brutal mob killing of a woman. Aisha Tanzim has more.
When 27-year-old Farkhunda Malikzada was brutally murdered by a mob in March, it led to widespread protests, calls for reform and an open trial with journalists and cameras in the courtroom. A couple of months later, an appeals court has overturned the verdict in an almost secretive hearing. No journalists, no cameras, not even Farkhunda's family were present in the courtroom. Fazil Manan Nuri, the defense attorney of one of the accused, Abdul Bashir, told VOA that three of the men convicted of the murder of Farkhunda Malikzada in March were instead given 20-year sentences. Farkhunda's family has expressed outrage and her father, Muhammad Nader, has called the ruling unacceptable. Aisha Tanzim, VOA News, Islamabad.
The British oil company BP agreed Thursday to pay $18.7 billion to settle the damage claims from the 2010 oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. Pam Bondi is the Attorney General for the state of Florida.
Just 5 years later, a potential ecological and economic tsunami has been avoided because good people all came together and decided it was time to do the right thing.
In the agreement reached with the U.S. Justice Department in five Gulf Coast U.S. states, BP said it would pay about $1 billion a year over the next 18 years. The blowout, 1.6 kilometers below the surface, set off an explosion aboard the Deepwater Horizon oil rig that killed 11 people and burned the rig. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Morning Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voices of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, July 3rd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Liberia confirms a third case of Ebola, and the citizens are concerned.
We want to say to our government it's frustrating, and we are confused because we were just announced Ebola-free. And we don't understand where was the government mechanism put to place.
Adolfo Kwini is the uncle of one of Liberia's newest Ebola victims. Kidnapping remains a lucrative trade for Nigeria's criminals. Amnesty International condemns mass expulsions of DRC nationals from Congo-Brazzaville. And Burundi's president campaigns for his third and controversial term despite international concerns.
The president is on a campaign trail for the last few days, and people are turning out in large numbers from his CNDD-FDD party, and the operation is going quite well.
Jeve Abayeho is the spokesman for Burundian President Pierre Nkurunziza. Cameroon truck drivers refuse to drive to Central African Republic. The United Nations says insecurity and donor fatigue threaten progress in Somalia. And we'll tell you why Malawians who fled xenophobic attacks in South Africa are returning there. Those stories plus Mark Oldman's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Liberia on Thursday confirmed a third case of Ebola just 2 months after the country was declared Ebola-free. But as Mariama Diallo reports from Senegal's capital, Dakar, health officials insist there's no need to panic.
The rituals of safe burials, contact tracing, quarantines, and hand washing are back again. William Cooper is a government official in one area where the disease reappeared and says residents have to be more careful than ever.
I think our people know we just have to come back to what we were doing before. Because we were doing hand washing, we're very careful, no handshaking.
Some just can't believe that Ebola is back so soon. Adolphus Gabene is the uncle of the first of Liberia's newest victims, 17-year-old Abraham Manegar. He says the government needs to take it very seriously.
We want to say to our government it's frustrating and we are confused because we were just announced Ebola-free. And we don't understand where was the government mechanism put to place that Ebola, we're hearing that it has come back to Liberia.
Health officials are moving quickly to contain this new outbreak. Meanwhile, Gabine's family is confined to their home in the village of Nindowen.
Sunday we did a burial and we came. But Monday in the morning, there we came and they said we got to stay here for 21 days.
While there's no choice about being quarantined, it presents a hardship for many.
I feel very bad about it because some of our school bear me, check that, and our hustle ain't gonna stop. I heard that both of these are coming quarantine out here. We ourselves feel bad about it.
Health officials say they have this outbreak under control and there is no need to panic. About 11,000 people died from Ebola over the past year. Close to 5,000 of them were Liberians. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, in Dakar.
Kidnapping has for years been rife in Nigeria's oil-producing Niger Delta region, but experts say the practice is now common across much of the country and kidnappers are becoming less discerning about their targets. Christine reports from Senegal's capital, Dakar.
It used to be that kidnappers would target only rich Nigerians and expatriates, mostly those working in the oil industry in the southern Niger Delta region. But security experts say it is not just foreigners and the wealthy who are at risk. Last May, prominent Nigerian author Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie's father was kidnapped as he was traveling in the country's southeast. She later wrote that his kidnappers told him he was targeted because his daughter was believed to be wealthy. The kidnappers are not confining themselves to the Niger Delta. An Argentine man was grabbed last month in the north-central Niger state. Last February, kidnappers abducted an American woman from Kogi state in the country's center. Both were later released. But Michael Klein, senior analyst with risk consultancy Drum Cusack, says kidnappings have been reported in about half of Nigeria's 36 states. A number of factors have led to the range and broadening of targets by kidnappers. Rich Nigerians and foreigners have now become riskier to kidnap, since some take security precautions to avoid abduction. That leaves kidnappers with no choice but to be less discerning about their targets and to spread across the country, says Klein.
Kidnapping gangs have had to find, you know, the best intersection of profit margins and vulnerability of their victims. That intersection usually lies in upper middle class professionals.
The kidnapping of oil workers was used as a tactic by militants in the Niger Delta, fighting for a greater share of the region's wealth. That was supposed to stop in 2009 when the government started paying them off in exchange for peace. But Klein says some militants decided to go elsewhere in Nigeria and continue kidnapping.
Migration in search of economic opportunity by decommissioned militants was the driver of the change in geographic scope.
Nigeria's often violent local politics also play a role, says Edward Aforome, a security consultant and retired police officer. Some politicians employ criminals as part of their campaign strategy around elections. Once those are over, Aforome says these criminals turn to kidnapping to make ends meet.
Arms we are giving to them to protect their masters. Those arms we are not withdrawn. A man has a gun and he has no job. He uses his gun to intimidate somebody else.
Klein says reports of kidnapping surged after Nigeria's presidential and parliamentary elections concluded in April, although they have tapered off in recent months. He says it is hard to know exactly how widespread the problem is. Many people do not report kidnappings to police for fear the hostages will be killed if officers attempt a rescue. Family members, friends, and employers then have no choice but to negotiate with the kidnappers. Klein says ransom demands start anywhere between $10,000 and $754,000. Chris Stein for VOA News, Dakar.
Burundi's President Pierre Nkurunziza has intensified his re-election bid for a controversial third term ahead of the July 15 presidential election. But opposition groups say they will not participate in the poll after accusing Mr. Nkurunziza of undermining the constitution by seeking a third term. They say the political environment is not suitable for credible elections, citing violence and security concerns that they say have led to more than 100,000 Burundians to flee to Rwanda and other neighboring countries. Presidential spokesman Gervais Abeyaho tells reporter Peter Clotty Mr. Nkurunziza's campaign is attracting lots of support across the country.
The president is on a campaign trail for the last few days, and people are turning out in large numbers from his CNDD-FDD party. And the operation is going quite well in the countryside and even the capital, Bujumbura.
A majority of the opposition say they are boycotting the election, so the election will not have the credibility that it deserves. What do you say to critics who say that he is running a one-man show of an election, that there is no international observer pretty much observing the election?
The president is not running a one-man show. I think the opposition here have been telling lies to the world because they said they were boycotting the election, but the last local and legislative election showed that members of those opposition parties have actually reported to vote. They reported to the polling stations. And one of the key opposition parties, Agathon Rwasa, actually came number two in the last local and legislative elections, which were held on the 29th of last month.
But they argue that they were already on the ballot before they decided to boycott the election. So a fresh ballot paper should have been printed for the election, but they used it, knowing very well that people were going to choose between the alternatives.
Yeah, but you cannot say you are boycotting the election when your people are reporting to vote. This is a contradiction. They should have told their members not to report to the polling stations altogether. But this did not happen. And we are expecting even those guys to report to even to the presidential election as well. Because otherwise, what will they tell their people? If their people go to vote for them and they don't turn out to receive those votes which they have put in the ballot for them.
There are refugees, over 100,000 of them Burundians, who have fled the country to neighboring countries, including Uganda, Rwanda, and Tanzania. How credible will this election be when over 100,000 people have gone out of the country because of the fear of violence?
I will tell you two to three things about this particular issue. First of all, the government has been launching an appeal for everybody who have left the country to come back and take part in the electoral process as Burundian citizens. Number two, these people have been coming back in numbers. We have at least, I don't have the exact figure as for now, but what I know is that these people are coming back from Rwanda, from Tanzania, from DRC, from Uganda, as you are saying. And number three, when we went to the election in 2005, close to 1 million people were outside following the civil war that had lasted for over 10 years. And this didn't prevent the election from taking place.
Gervais Habayeho is the spokesman for Burundian President Pierre Nkurunziza. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotte from the capital, Bujumbura. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, July 3rd. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 16 minutes past the hour. Amnesty International says abuses committed in the Republic of Congo during last year's deportation of tens of thousands of people to the Democratic Republic of Congo could amount to crimes against humanity. Nick Long has more from the DRC.
In a report published Thursday, Amnesty describes a range of human rights violations allegedly committed by Congo-Brazzaville's security forces between April and September of last year during mass expulsions of DRC nationals. The organization says at least 179,000 DRC citizens were expelled at that time from the neighboring country and that the deportations have continued this year. Congo-Brazzaville has said previously that the DRC nationals are illegal foreign workers. Amnesty's report on this police operation is named Mbate Yabakolo, which means slap of the elders in the Congolese language, Lingala. It documents reports of arbitrary arrests, extortion and theft, rapes and fatalities. Some of these crimes were allegedly committed by Congo-Brazzaville police. Amnesty International researcher Evie Frank told VOA about testimony she heard from a deportee. She says a woman who was a street vendor told her that one day police came and stole $300 from her and her merchandise. When she and four of her colleagues fled, the police chased them and they were raped one after the other. When the women tried to get to a hospital, they were denied access, says Frank. The report documents several similar cases. The operation was initially launched in response to crimes committed by gang members from Kinshasa who had fled to Brazzaville to escape a police crackdown in the DRC. But Amnesty says it was soon extended to any DRC citizens and police used radio to broadcast appeals to the public to denounce so-called criminal households while recording artists composed songs openly inciting discrimination against foreigners. Landlords were fined $600 for so-called illegal households, according to the report. Video footage of abuses in Brazzaville has been widely seen in the DRC. The footage includes scenes where women were surrounded by men who kicked and punched them and then pulled off their clothes. Evie Frank tells VOA that Amnesty interviewed 110 people who were victims of the operation and more than 50% said they were victims of arbitrary arrest. She says the mass expulsions without due process and forcible returns of refugees and asylum seekers were in contravention of international law. A number of people were reportedly killed during the expulsions, Frank said, although she could not give a death toll. She spoke to one man who lost his wife as they were being pushed onto a ferry to take them across the Congo River to Kinshasa. She says he told her that as they were putting their belongings on the boat, his wife was pushed into the water by a policeman and she drowned in front of him. He was never able to recover his wife's body, she says. Amnesty has called on the Republic of Congo to bring to justice those suspected of crimes, including possibly crimes against humanity, committed during the operation. Nick Long for VOA, Goma.
Truck drivers have refused to drive goods and humanitarian assistance from the seaport in Cameroon to the troubled Central African Republic following repeated attacks by armed men. The landlocked Central African Republic depends solely on the seaport in Douala for supplies. As Moki Edwin Kizika reports from Douala, the Central African Republic has dispatched authorities to negotiate with the drivers.
Elhaj Umaru of the Cameroon Syndicate of Truck Drivers says within the past 2 weeks, their trucks transporting humanitarian aid and other supplies from the Douala seaport in Cameroon to Bangui in the troubled Central African Republic are increasingly being targeted by suspected rebels.
Il y a 11 morts, 2 disparus jusqu'à date. Mais ce qui est le plus important, c'est que ce n'est...
He says 11 truck drivers have been killed and 2 are still missing. He says what is very annoying is that only Cameroonians are targeted by the suspected rebels. Ibrahim Yaya truck driver and president of the group of CAR drivers plying the Douala-Bangui corridor, says in less than 2 weeks, at least a dozen of their colleagues have been taken to hospitals for treatment of wounds inflicted by the heavily armed suspected rebels.
Nous sommes victimes de tueries, de bastonnades. Également, nos patrons perdent leur bien.
He says they are victims of rebels who regularly beat them and amputate their bodies or even kill to seize goods and money and destroy their trucks. The Central African Republic has seen violence and chaos for more than 2 years. In March 2013, the Muslim-backed Seleka militia seized the capital Bangui. President Francois Bozize fled to Cameroon, and Michel Djotodia, who had been one of the Seleka leaders, made himself president. The Christian anti-Balaka started fighting back, running the country into chaos. Chechuma Bandla, media officer at the Douala Seaport, says since then, the volume of goods to CAR has been increasing, but the strike started by truck drivers may make things worse.
The situation in the Republic of Central Africa has induced a lot of importations. We published a list of 2,502 containers that have been abandoned at the port for more than 3 months.
Elias Sylvain Yaba, the CAR's Director General of Transport, says he was dispatched to Douala by his government to negotiate with the truck drivers to return to work.
Cette rencontre pour nous permettre de cerner déjà tous les goulots d'étanglement.
He says the meeting has enabled them to take appropriate measures to assure the security of truck drivers and the protection of trucks along the Douala Cameroon Bangui CAR corridor. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Douala.
The outgoing United Nations humanitarian chief for Somalia, Filippi Lazzarini, says Somalia is on the right development trajectory following years of chaos. But he tells viewers Gabe Jaslow, donor fatigue and insecurity continue to threaten Somalia's fragile progress.
During the past 2 years as humanitarian coordinator for Somalia, Lazzarini helped guide aid efforts to the country as it recovered from famine and solidified the shape and function of a new government. The Swiss diplomat, who concludes his second tenure in the position Thursday, says he sees positive signs all around.
Mogadishu, for example, you wouldn't recognize. You have traffic jam, you have even traffic lights, you have a new airport, you have one of the most modern hospitals of Eastern Africa. You hear the hammer quite a lot, and you have a number of people of the diaspora, I mean, who have come back and looking at investment possibilities.
Of course, some of the familiar challenges remain. Al-Shabaab militants continue to attack government and international actors across the country, greatly impeding humanitarian work. Lazzarini says the security situation has been his main frustration.
During my tenure, we have been directly targeted 6 times. We had 7 international staff who perished. We had tens of bystanders who have been killed. And despite all the measures we are taking, I mean, we are still target of this.
While the country has mostly recovered from the 2011 famine, the UN says some 730,000 people, about 10% of the population, still face acute food insecurity. Lazzarini says the country needs continued international support to weather future shocks, but acknowledges that with so many other crises around the world, maintaining funding for Somalia is a challenge.
We are aware that there is a competing environment, but we have also to make sure that this, I would say, positive narrative in the making not be undermined by all of suddenly, I mean, dropping the humanitarian agenda.
Lazzarini will take up a new position as the humanitarian coordinator for Lebanon. His replacement, Peter de Klerk of the Netherlands, who previously served as the UN humanitarian lead in Haiti, is expected to begin his tenure July 12th. Gabe Jocelot, VOA News, Nairobi.
Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. And here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Friday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa sports news, we begin with volleyball. Kenya play Mexico and hosts Algeria engage Australia at the Women's World Volleyball Grand Prix in Algiers today, Friday. Tomorrow, Saturday, Kenya play Australia as Algeria face Mexico. On Sunday, Australia engage Mexico as Algeria challenge Kenya. In basketball, Egypt play Tunisia in a classification tie at the Men's World Under-19 Basketball Championships in Heraklion, Greece, today, Friday. In rugby, the Confederation of African Rugby Division 1B Africa Cup contest starts in Kampala, Uganda, today, Friday. The week-long round-robin contest features Botswana, Ivory Coast, Mauritius, Madagascar, Senegal, and hosts Uganda. Turning to athletics, Africa's top female sprinters, Blessing Okagbare Igote Gwonor, along with Ivory Coast's Muriel Lahore and Marie-José Talou, compete in 100 meters at the IAAF Diamond League in Paris, France, today, Saturday. East Africa's long-distance rivalry comes alive in women's 5,000 meters, where Ethiopia's Almaz Ayana, Genzebe Dibaba, and Belianesh Oljira face Kenya's Mercy Cherono, Viola Jelagat Kibiwot, and Faith Chepngetich Kibiegon. Algerian Olympic champion Taufik Makloufi heads Africa's charge in men's 1,500 meters, which also features Ethiopian Aman Wote, Moroccan Abdel Lati Gida, and Djibouti's Ayanle Suleiman. Kenyan Eunice Sum competes in women's 800 meters as South Africans Wade Fanny Kirk and Wenda Nell compete in men's 400 meters and women's 400 meter hurdles, respectively. Kenyans look to dominate the men's 3,000 meter steeplechase, where Olympic champion Ezekiel Kemboi faces Jairus Kipchoge Birech, Brimin Kipruto, Paul Kipsiele Koech, and Conseslus Kipruto. South Africans Kotso Mokwena and Sunet Fulyun contest the men's long jump and women's javelin, respectively. In football, Liberia host Guinea in Monrovia in their Orange Africa Nations Championship qualifier on Sunday. It will be the first match played in Liberia since the lifting of the ban on football in the country as a measure to curb the spread of the Ebola virus. In other matches, Gambia host Senegal, Kenya play Ethiopia, and Angola face Swaziland. Elsewhere, Botswana play Lesotho, Burundi encounter Djibouti, Seychelles engage Mozambique, Zambia host Namibia, Comoro Islands challenge Zimbabwe, Uganda play Tanzania, Mauritius face South Africa, and Mali engage Guinea-Bissau. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Omer in Johannesburg, South Africa, wishing you all a sporty weekend. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good weekend, and we see you again on Monday morning. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. United Nations observers say Monday's parliamentary elections in Burundi were not free, fair, transparent, or credible. The UN Electoral Observer Mission said the elections took place in a tense political crisis and a climate of widespread fear and intimidation in parts of the country. The opposition boycotted the parliamentary election. Burundi has been locked in its worst political crisis since its civil war ended a decade ago. Suspected Boko Haram militants have killed nearly 150 people in attacks in northeastern Nigeria. In the worst attack, officials say 97 people were killed in the town of Kukawa near Lake Chad on Wednesday evening. According to witnesses, gunmen entered mosques and shot men as they prayed before the end of the Ramadan fast. And six United Nations peacekeepers were killed and five wounded in an attack in Mali's restive northern desert. That is it for this Friday, July 3rd edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Mark Oman, along with our engineer Dave Magnus, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing all of you a very good weekend.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa. The political crisis in South Sudan is taking a heavy toll on the nation's citizens. Nearly 2 million people have been displaced due to the fighting between supporters of President Salva Kiir and opposition leader Riek Machar. Tune in on Wednesday at 18:30 UTC on VOA Africa.
VOA. On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kilohertz and 15580 kilohertz. We are also live on the Internet at www.voaafrica.com.